Hello and welcome to the next segment of Buffalo Who Knew, a podcast series which highlights the often underappreciated, sometimes unearthed assets of Buffalo, the great city of Buffalo, particularly as it relates to art and culture and the built-in natural environments. And I am thrilled to be here with Kelly Macaloni, who is going to talk to us today about this incredible project that she has taken on surrounding the now increasingly famed and recognized architect Louise Blanchard Bethune. And I'm, of course, with my compadre Newell. So, Kelly, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
We're thrilled to have you. And I've been wanting to have you on this podcast since the day I started it. So let's dig in. Let's hear a little bit more about you and your background. You're an architect. You work out at the University of Buffalo. You manage the campus, from what I understand.
And correct. Yeah, I'm Canadian. I was.
We love Canadians. Thank you for being here.
I'm dual, Canadian and American. Mm-hmm. So I'm a bit of a unicorn in that regard. I'm from Newfoundland, Canada. No Newfie jokes, please. And
I didn't even know that there are Newfie jokes.
Most
are there?
Buffalonians know Newfie,
really?
Newfie jokes.
Yeah, we just love the Newfie dogs.
Yeah, so I studied in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Dalhousie University, graduated in 94, and then moved to Ithaca, New York, worked for a playground, a community design playground architect for 5 years. Yeah. All those wooden castle-like structures that were big in the 90s. I worked on that for 5 years and then moved to Buffalo in 1998 with my husband now. And I've been here ever since. And I just love this city so much. And our network of friends, we're all culturals and we're most of us are not from here. And we just really are in love with Buffalo, you know, so.
So how did you get interested in Louise? Is Louise Bethune?
Yes, so she's the first professional woman architect in the United States and quite possibly in the world. And she was born in Waterloo, New York, mostly raised in Buffalo, moved here with her family at the age of 11.
What year was that?
That would have been in 1868. Okay. So right after the Civil War, she moved. And it was during the time, of course, when Buffalo was starting to, boom, right? And she was here so all of those years. She died when she was 1913, when she was 56. And attended Buffalo Central High School. Her parents were educators, and somewhere along the line, as a high school student or younger, she decided she wanted to be an architect, and she was mocked for it by her classmates, and that just made her more stubborn to pursue it, became interested in designing house plans, et cetera, to the point where when she graduated from Buffalo High School, she stayed on to attend their honors program or the college prep program. I wanted to pursue Cornell University. It just opened its the Land Grant Institute, and had just opened its architecture program, and she wanted to attend.
And did women do that at that time?
So the Land Grant, many schools did not, but the Land Grant institutions allowed women to pursue co-education. Mm. So that was a huge benefit of all the Land Grant institutes. MIT. Just so you know, it was a land grant institute in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. UMass Amherst, that's also land grant, but MIT was one of the first, and it was the first architecture school and the first to graduate women architects. Mm. That in Illinois, Urbana, it's another land grant institute. So anyway, so yeah, there were a few during this era, but she received an opportunity to work for Richard Waite, who was a very prominent architect. He was known
in Buffalo,
and he ended up going on to become very well known in Toronto and Montreal, Hamilton. So he designed what was a German insurance building right at the corner, right at the Lafayette Square. So a lot of Louise's life, really, ground zero is Lafayette Square. Mm-hmm. And so she received an opportunity to work for him. And so she took it and worked for 5 years for him, met her husband, Robert, there. And then in 1881, decided to open up her own office. But I think she and Robert were planning to go into practice together. She just had funding from her parents, and so she opened the office. So, before we move on.
What an incredible, you know, trailblazer. Do you think she would have called herself a feminist back then?
So, yeah, it's a very good question. So maybe not feminist, because the term really did not become well known until the 1900s.
Of course, yeah.
So it's not a term she would have recognized. Right. But she certainly, by our standards today, I would say absolutely she was a feminist. Mm-hmm. I do not have a recommendation, or I don't have any records of her stating she was a suffragist. Mm. And we tend to confuse or combine suffrage and feminism as the same, but they're very different. Mm-hmm. Feminism is about equality. Mm-hmm. And suffrage was earning the vote to pursue those other elements of women's equality. And those other elements would be personhood, coeducation, the right to pay equity, the opportunity to have clubs, have hobbies, go outside unchaperoned, the ability to dress reform, be able to wear what you want. All of these are elements of equality in society. Women had none of those in the mid-1800s. Mm-hmm. And so she demonstrated that she was interested and a beneficiary, A or B, advocated actively in pursuit of those other tracks. Suffrage, the vote, I cannot claim. Mm-hmm. And I actually think she was, her father and her husband were both members of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. You know, side note, the Republican Party is not the Republican Party of today. Of course, you know, yeah. This was
inverted.
So this is Lincoln's Republican Party we're talking about.
Right.
And so I suspect that they were very much a political family, but she felt that because she was, you know, a professional woman in a relatively conservative area, that she needed to sort of not engage in politics. So she was not an active reformer per se, or an active activist.
However, I did read in some articles that she did take a strong position around the Pan Am.
And, she did.
And let's talk about that.
Yep. Yeah, there are a few things that she's known for. So first of all, her favorite typology was a school, educational architecture. She often credited her parents. So she practiced in Buffalo during the time when when population was surging and we did not have a very good school building system. So due to the reformers at the time, they've restructured the Buffalo Public Schools so that they could build a lot more schools. So she and her firm were the beneficiary of that work at that time. And so they designed 15 schools. So that's one of her great successes. She's also... Sadly, none of her buildings, no. A lot of them were lost in the 20s and the 50s because basically the districts maintained the properties and then they replaced their out-of-date buildings.
Are the images...
Oh, yeah, we have images.
We can still see what she did? Okay.
Yeah. A lot of them were in the Queen Anne style or derivative styles, but in particular, they liked Queen Anne, not just her and Robert. To your point about the Columbian Exposition, she was, by the time the Columbian Exposition design competition was announced, was 1891. She was a member of the AIA, American Institute of Architects. She was a member of the Western Association of Architects. She was,
which I understand that Burnham and Sullivan supported.
Yeah, so she was very close friends with those Chicago progressive architects, and they were very active in her rising and being accepted in these associations. So she had contacts on the inside, as it were, in Chicago. The problem was that, you know, the Columbian Exposition was really run by a series of, you know, very well-connected men, largely from Chicago, but, you know, others from outside in Washington, et cetera. So the women's building was led by a board of lady managers who were largely socialites, some from outside of Chicago, but half of them were from Chicago proper. And they insisted upon a woman designing their building, which is a good thing, all good, but they wanted to do it by design competition because they stated that there was no woman who was elevated in the profession enough to just be able to secure the commission, whereas all of the other buildings, agriculture, manufacturing, et cetera, they were all distributed to the best and brightest architects, as, you know, Daniel Burnham and Root determined. I mean, and they were really the
best. So it's a little bit of a catch-22.
Exactly. So this woman, Bertha Palmer, who was the president of Lady Board of Managers, and her husband was a very well-connected hotelier in Chicago at the time, she insisted on the design competition. And then I don't know why this happened, but they insisted that the winner of the design competition would be the recipient of $1,000. And that was her complete fee to take the project from inception to completion. The male architects for their projects received $10,000, and they only had to take them up to design schematics, whereas the woman had to take them through the construction documents. And these all buildings were, they were all temporary buildings, of course. So Burnham and, well, would have been Root if he hadn't died, they were in charge of actually building these buildings. So anyway, she refused to submit a design.
She took a stand. Yeah.
She took a stand for a number of reasons. The first, the most important, was pay equity. Mm-hmm. She was so offended that the woman who won this competition would receive 1/10 what the male architects received. But then also, she also took a stand that women had to compete against each other for a project where her male compatriots were gifted them. They were, you know, so it was both maybe a little pride, but mostly
principle.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, so, that was like the White City, the Columbian Exposition, that was a big deal across the whole country. I mean, the United States saw this as our opportunity to demonstrate to Europe and to the world that we were, you know, a force.
Right.
And so it was not even a city place of pride. It was like the whole country was, you know, because it was in, you know, it was in, the whole project was to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the discovery of the New World. Mm-hmm. And so the whole country was so proud of this festival. And so she was devastated that she didn't have an opportunity to participate.
Well, but meanwhile, her own firm with her husband is growing.
Yes,
and I read that they had 180 commissions or?
We know now of 180 projects, but we think it's probably twice that. And there are 30 of them that are standing, they're extant. And most of her practice was largely based in Western New York, as far as Dunkirk. There's talk of some projects in Massachusetts, but I haven't been, and she had family there, so it's quite possible, but I haven't been able to find them. But, you know, Lockport High School was one of the last educational projects that she did, and that sadly was demolished in the 50s. A lot of houses in the Elmwood Village. So this, you know, the Elmwood Village in downtown, that's really her area.
Yeah. Do we know how many in that area?
Houses? Yeah. Oh, I do.
Approximately.
About 30.
About 30.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So she had a practice that spanned from, you know, public schools to hotel, you know, obviously
residential, anyone, architecture, industry, commercial, all of it.
And
police station.
Anyone who's been to Buffalo or knows Buffalo, probably the most visible is the Lafayette Hotel.
Yes,
which absolutely was restored 20 years ago. It's in the downtown. Let's talk about that building. Was that done for the Pan Am?
It was done. The inception of it was during the Pan American Exposition, but not necessarily done for it because it opened in 1904. Mm-hmm. But the thought was, or right around the turn of the century, that the city had the Iroquois Hotel, and the thought was that the city had grown enough that it could support two luxury hotels. Mm. And in the book, I describe the arduous route it took for the Hotel Lafayette to come into being, and most of it was due to funding. So it went through multiple iterations. It went through multiple financiers, multiple design consultants who were responsible for it for a long time. They referred to the site as the hole in the ground because they demolished this wonderful St. Peter's Church, mm-hmm. which was a really important site for Buffalo because it was where the Free Soil Convention was. And the Free Soil Convention, most of you probably are aware, was the predecessor. It was the first abolitionist advocacy movement, and we held the first Free Soil Convention in Buffalo, where people from the entire country came together to talk about how to eliminate or how to outlaw slavery. Mm-hmm. Most of those people, those men who came to Buffalo for that Free Soil Convention, ended up working for Lincoln during his tenure. Anyway, I digress, but it was a really important site, is my point. Mm-hmm. And it was a hole in the ground for several years because the original funders didn't have enough capital to complete the project. So finally, and they tried to blame it on Louise, the woman architect. She doesn't know what she's doing. Well, no, the problem was these guys didn't have enough money. They didn't have the capital. Mm-hmm. Finally, we were able to find McDuffie from Rochester, the liquor magnate. He was the one who finally came and had the funding, and they were able to build it. So it opened in June of 1904.
And it's beautiful Renaissance revival.
French Renaissance. And it was really, one of my favorite quotes from the Buffalo Courier was that, It's a beauty, such a beautiful, you know, the renderings, it's a beauty. So she, after all of these years, 10 plus 12 years of, you know, being left behind in a way by her former friends and colleagues, Burnham Root, she had her opus, and I referred to Le Lafayette Hotel as her opus. And it was an immediate success. Mm. And then as soon as they opened, they started plans for an addition. Mm-hmm. And actually the addition is, you know, at the end, that's the project she it was her last project. Okay. There was a lot of projects in between, but that was the Lafayette Hotel was the project ultimately that killed her because she took a fall during a site visit and broke a bone in her back. And so she never fully recovered after that.
Mm-hmm. I never heard that.
Yep. Yeah. So
that's incredible.
I know. She took a fall while she was inspecting. Mm.
So you've taken on this monumental task of elevating the visibility of Louise Blanchard Bethune. Now, let's talk about the book you've written and the title, Every Woman Her Own Architect.
Yeah.
Talk about that title.
So one of the things, so when I received a cache of materials from Bethune, but from Adriana Barbash, who was a woman architect who had been researching Bethune, and she retired, and so she gave me the materials in 2004. And when I started to do research, I had a lot of luck because I became very close with Cynthia Van Ness and the Buffalo History Museum, and they provide a lot of good information. So Cynthia Van Ness was the one, thank you, Cynthia, for passing.
Who has her hands in so many good things in Buffalo.
Oh, yeah, things come back to Cynthia. Yeah. So she gave me an article that talked about the Buffalo Women's Wheel and Athletic Club. And in this little article from 1892, it talked about how the lady architect, Ms. Bethune, was the first woman to own her own bicycle, and it cost $150 at the time. So as soon as I read that, I thought, okay, there's more here than meets the eye. She is not this like anti-feminist, dowdy kind of woman that people tend to think. This is something here. Anyway, I went down to the Grosvenor. Grosvenor Library has some really great collections, and one of them is the Buffalo Women's Wheel and Athletic Club collection. And in those, there's all the pamphlets from their special annual dinners where they would toast each other. And one of the toasts that Louise gave was, every woman should be her own architect. So the quote is directly from Louise, and she was talking about women riders and having the ability to define who they are. And
freedom, transportation. Freedom. Yep.
Yeah. Susan B. Anthony talked about how it did more to emancipate women than anything else.
Yeah.
And so I just really love that aspect of Louise, because it demonstrates, where if you just look at her architecture or just look at, you know, her AIA involvement, you get a very different picture than when you look at this whole side of her and you read those meeting minutes and you see how active she was, how opinionated, how much fun they had. It gives a totally different dimension. So these women, there's a great article, profile of her in the early 1890s, where it talks about how she, you know, loves to ride her bicycle to construction sites and around town.
So cool.
And then in the meeting minutes, they talk about how they would go on trips during the day, during the week, but on weekends, they would take their bicycles, get up at 6 a.m. and ride to Lockport or Niagara Falls or East Aurora. Now we in Buffalo know what that means today.
That's right.
Joe, so imagine what that was like at the time when you paved roads ended, you know, probably just outside the inner sanctum of the city. And then after that, you're talking dirt roads. Mm. And so they did that in long skirts. They did not wear bloomers or divided skirts as they were time.
Wow.
And they would ride there with their little thermos of coffee. They would ride to these places, have lunch, 6 hours, whatever, and then they would take the train back. Mm. So these were this group of women, they thought they were the first club in the world. They were the second in the United States. So the first women's bicycle club was opened or founded in Washington, D.C., where the safety bicycle that they used was invented in January of 1888. And so our club was founded in June of 1888.
Mm-hmm. So I remember reading a number of years ago a piece from the New York Times sort of calling...
Overlook No More. Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Calling out the visibility of, the most prominent women architects. And then post that was
the
Overlook No More article about Louise Bethune. How is the architecture world responding to, you know, having her, you know, being overlooked, or are they circling back and saying, yes, she's part of the canon?
Right. So we are going through a moment right now, and we have been for the past 10 years or so, maybe 15 years, where women are demanding that there's more research done on women architects. And so there's a lot of scholarship around this this genre, and some of them are in the form of monographs like mine, and some of them are in the form of surveys like, you know, others that you'll find. You can find, actually, the Martin House has all of these wonderful books. And then there's a lot of wonderful websites. The Beverly Willis Architecture Foundation, based in New York, they have a really great online source that has a terrific website devoted to early women architects, and Bethune is an entry in that. So she is, I guess the community is very engaged in her story, very much so. You know, her, she's not it's not like Julia Morgan, who had this, you know, unbelievable support and, you know, did, you know, works of art, really works of art. Louise's, her pioneering, like her creation is herself, I guess, if I can put it that way. And she's just, and I think that that needs to be placed in that context. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to think about architecture and what architects do differently than what we have been for a long time. Since, I would say, since the modern era, we tend to think about architecture in terms of the master architect or the artist and, you know, the hero, as a hero. And that is not, architecture was never, it's never been created that way, even during the myth that many male architects proposed. It's a team sport. Mm-hmm. And architects are best served when they are fully engaged in their community and they contribute to their community. And I really applaud the work that you do, Fritz, for the same reason, because you know you are trying to make your place a better place, right? In context.
Well, and I learned it all from Newell.
Oh, so. Yeah, whatever.
Right. But you know, there's nothing wrong with saying, this community doesn't need this standalone object that, you know, that is isolated, stands out from its community. Actually, it's much better when the fabric is stronger. Now, I don't want to take anything away from some of those architects, but I would put Louise in the cohort of architects who want to improve their neighborhoods by strengthening its context.
Mm, wonderful, wonderful. So along the lines of this podcast, and I mean, I think I can pull out three from our conversation of who knew, you know, who knew that the first woman architect was in Buffalo. Who knew that she was also the first woman to buy a bicycle? I mean, so
first woman to own a bicycle in Buffalo.
Exactly.
One of the first women in the United States to ride a bicycle, I would say.
Yeah.
So is there another factoid that you want to impart to our audience of who knew about Louise?
Well, you know, she designed one of the first luxury hotels in the country. I think that's, you know, really, really important.
Incredible. What were some of the amenities that she brought to the market that hadn't been?
Well, it was the whole idea of a fireproof facility that you could actually, you know, that had, you know, it sounds silly, but, you know, private bathrooms and, you know, indoor plumbing, but the big thing is the fireproofing. So one of the projects that Louise worked on when she joined Waight was the Pierce Palace Hotel, which is located right here where
on Porter,
where Juville. That wooden structure stood for 1 year, and it was open in 1876, and it burned in 1877. So fireproofing was a big deal. So
it was wooden, right?
It was a wooden structure, right? Yeah. So I think it was a very beautiful, elegant design that was also incredibly safe and practical and on budget, and it was what an architect should do: over deliver, and. Anybody who comes to Buffalo, I just encourage you to visit it because I think I give Rocco, you know, a lot of credit for the work that they did.
And speaking of Rocco, when I remember this hotel back in the day,
oh my God,
it was not such a great hotel. It was a flop house.
And it was painted blue.
Yeah.
It was painted brutal.
It had blue in it. Yeah. So I was, when I became the president of AIA, New York State in 2012, it was when this opened. And one of the great things about being president is you're able to, you know, give citations or, you know, presidential awards as fitting. And I gave the Lafayette Hotel an award because I really wanted to celebrate, well, first of all, the New York State Historic Tax Credits, because it was the first project that took advantage of it. I wanted to celebrate Rocco and his team, and also wanted to celebrate Carmina Morris Wood because of the painstaking work that they did, and they just deserve so much. And when anybody in this area, I'm sure you're all part of these conversations where you think about when did the Renaissance begin in Buffalo? I go back to when that opened.
I agree.
Absolutely.
I agree. 1,000%.
Yeah. The Queen City opened its women's opus. Exactly. It really was. You know, you just felt like all of a sudden Lafayette Hotel, our town square.
Right.
Where we've
so much damage has happened.
Exactly. And then to see this grand lady restored, lovingly restored. Right. That is.
Well, yeah. I look forward to seeing where we're going to see more of you and Louise. And I envision that there will be a major exhibition on her at the newly to open Architecture Center.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. I very much hope so.
Appropriate.
Yes.
And thank you so much for coming and sharing with us and talking about us. And I can't wait to read the book. I haven't read it yet, so I look forward to reading it.
Thank you. I really appreciate everything both of you have done for the city, and much to do, but makes me so happy to just to learn everything that you're doing.
Another Renaissance right now.